Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie joined by John as always. What is happening?
Not a whole lot. That's a lot. There's a lot going
There's
on.
There's a lot.
Things are great.
Things it's are busy. Like
it's fall. The weather is perfect. And I just have to remind myself that slower days are soon to come.
This is the time
I'm lying to myself.
Slow days to be outside and enjoying the beautiful weather here in Kentucky. Hopefully those of our listeners that have been impacted by severe weather are doing okay. And then hopefully we're all in for some good weather coming up, but we are in for some good murder discussion today.
Yeah. So dude, you have been so busy, but yet seem so calm. How are you doing that?
I'm about 3 months into this round of Magic Mind. We've done it before. But I've been taking that mental performance shot every day for 3 months now, and I just feel so on top of it. I've more than doubled our TikTok following. We're putting out more and more bonus content, working on wrapping up a novel. There's so much going on, but I feel ahead, and I feel motivated, and I feel like I have a clear mind to do this kinds of things. Magic Mind is a very natural, very well-researched product that is, like I said, they define it as a mental performance shot. And I think that's a great way to look at it. I feel alert. I feel clear in the afternoon. I have extra energy. I start out the morning with a bang, and then it has helped me. I've started going to the gym, and I have the energy to do that in the evenings, whereas normally I would have crashed back then.
And it's not a caffeine shot, so it doesn't give you tons of energy for just a few hours and then leave you with a crash. Like, it is a gentle, sustained, great, like, motivational feeling all day long. I used to have, like, a midday slump where at, like, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm done, I need a nap, things just aren't good. That's all gone, thanks to Magic Mind.
And you can get 40% off your subscription using our new code VIPJ&J. 40. That's magicmind.com/VIPJ&J40 to get 40% off your subscription. And that's only available for the first 10 orders. So head over there quickly and don't forget the code VIPJ&J40.
Jamie, I want to say thank you to a very special person. That is AJ for joining Patreon. AJ and everyone else that has joined will get a bonus episode each and every month. So just next week, guys, you're going to get one. Actually, it'll be this weekend. This is October's flying by. November will be here before you know it. Go ahead and sign up for patreon.com for as little as $3 a month. You get a bonus episode and you get all of our other content early and ad free.
We had a bonus episode yesterday where we interviewed Harry from the Rachel Cancer Scam podcast called The Messenger. And I mean, it's a wild conversation. It came out yesterday on our feed, but our Patreon listeners had it for almost a week before that. So trying to get that out to you guys. But if you haven't, I encourage you to listen to that. This is such a wild story that hearing it directly from Harry in a way that in his show is very scripted. He's very direct. So we get a little bit more unhinged, I think. Is that the right word?
Yeah, it's certainly wild. And I didn't go into it on the air, but it reminded me of a story from my teenage years, and maybe on Patreon I'll tell you that story. So, Jamie, help me remember.
Yeah.
But, guys, we've got a wild case for you as well today.
Yeah, and I can't wait to get into this. This is one that I've known about for a long time, and it's been on our list, and glad we finally got around to it. But why don't you get us rolling?
In 2021, the True Crime podcast world saw the debut of Murder in Alliance. This podcast centered around the killing of 26-year-old Yvonne Lane of Alliance, Ohio, and it was sponsored by the Obsessed Network. Murder in Alliance was written and hosted by journalist Maggie Freeling, and it followed two private investigators from Proclaim Justice. Proclaim Justice is an innocence group co-founded by Jason Baldwin, who was one of the members of the West Memphis Three.
I know we don't normally get to shout out every podcast that covers a case that we talk about, but Murder and Alliance really has done the most work on this case. So most of the information came from that investigation, and it's a really good listen. You get interviews, but today we're going to break it down true crime cast style. On April 1st of 1999, Tanya Lane went to her daughter Yvonne's house to drive her 6-year-old granddaughter to school. When she got there, she saw a terrifying sight. It's a brutal, bloody crime scene. Her throat had been cut. There was blood all over the house. So Tanya immediately ran across the street to a neighbor's house to call 911. When police and first responders got there, children were inside and were all very unharmed. They also found that Yvonne's body had been dragged throughout her home and laid to rest in the living room, since there was really blood almost throughout the house, and it was obvious that she had been dragged. She was found with several objects against and on top of her in a way that had to be done manually, not in just a, there was a scuffle and this is how things landed kind of way. It was a very odd scene, but also obviously very brutal.
So the podcast Murder and Alliance brought up some questionable moments in the case. And the first of those was kind of right off the bat. And that is when the chief of police, Larry Doherty, would arrive on the scene. And according to the podcast, he showed up to the scene with a date. Like he was on a date, but he brought the date with him.
I can't imagine that's best practice for law enforcement. Never been an officer, but I would think the date would not come to the murder scene?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a police officer, but I do handle sensitive matters, and my children are not allowed to come to work with me, let alone my wife, because that's just not okay.
Right.
And this will come up later, but just know eventually Larry Doherty sued the podcast makers for calling this person a date, and according to him, he said the person was participating in a ride-along program and was observing police work. You and I both know that's never really that official. You can literally take anyone you want. So it could have been both. It could have been right. A date who was doing a ride along. Nevertheless, there were more issues than just that at the crime scene. We'll start with no one was wearing shoe coverings or gloves to protect the evidence. So it was really just, I don't know. It, as far as crime scenes go, it was anarchy. You need to be really careful when you're walking into a scene like this to preserve evidence and to keep things exactly they were when you found them. They would have to move around the room, and when they would do so, they would just step over her body and move around the room, not wearing any protection like the gloves or the foot protectors. Authorities did have to move the children out of the house. Again, they were there, but they were unharmed. So the police went in and they brought a blanket from Yvonne's bedroom, and then they covered her body with that blanket so the children couldn't see it. That, in my mind, is a critical mistake for several reasons. You don't want to move anything else in the house either. There could be evidence there, and potentially you've contaminated two scenes, right?
Right.
So I think you, where are the white blankets that you always see on television? Do they, I'm speaking kind of tongue in cheek, but do they not have something else that's somewhat more controlled they could have put over her to get the children out? And I'm sure this is just freaking chaotic too. But when the children were out of the home, they ended up putting that blanket back on Yvonne's bed. So it's a back and forth game with this blanket, and it could hold keys to solving this crime.
Yeah, it could be, like you said, disturbing each scene or removing evidence from her body or adding things to her body that shouldn't be there.
I was like, you have to think about this case is eventually going to go to trial, and that is something that would definitely be used in questioning. Like, well, how do you know that didn't get there from the bedroom?
Right.
It could have been anywhere in the house because you use this all over the place.
Or they dragged it inside from their feet because they didn't wear shoe coverings. Now, this was 1999, and at that time, only about 18,000 people lived in Alliance. It's a small town, and I think we try to acknowledge that maybe this department didn't have a lot of practice with these types of scenes, but I don't think it's an excuse to be that careless. The floor of the crime scene was absolutely covered in blood. They determined that the victim's throat was cut while she stood facing the sliding glass door of the balcony. The murder weapon had been wiped on the living room couch where the body was found. There was a bloody footprint on the victim's back showing that the assailant had stepped on her at some point, maybe when leaving the scene or moving the body. There were several bloody footprints in the home, which were gathered by cutting the wood floor around the footprints with a circular saw. And I don't know best practice there, John, of if there's a way to otherwise preserve them, but I also hope that I know when you saw things, debris comes out of the actual cutting and can also contaminate. The stairs were never processed. There were no usable fingerprints found and collected at the scene. And as far as we know, there was no DNA that was recovered. Again, 1999, maybe not thinking as much about DNA at the time. The time of death was determined to be sometime after 7 a.m. and the coroner couldn't remember if he had done a sexual assault kit or not.
Oh my God.
I've never been a coroner either. I think I would remember like doing a sexual assault kit. Again, this is a small town. I can't imagine he did a lot of these. I would think it would be memorable.
I feel like if you weren't certain, I mean, I don't know. I don't understand how you're not certain.
Right.
Was the coroner drunk when he responded to this? Because like this would be so traumatic. I don't care how many traumatic things you've seen, you're going to remember this. Right. Right.
Yeah. And I would think if you did the kit, you would have some kind of results somewhere. So if he doesn't remember and doesn't have evidence, I'm going to assume he didn't do it. She also had a bruise on her thigh. She had been hit in the head, and those are mentioned in the autopsy, but never explained of how they possibly happened, of whether they could have been from a fall, how old the bruise was, or anything like that.
Some people might be listening and say, well, how would you know? Like, if you were hit by something, how are you able to know what you were hit with? But I've been trained, and social workers have been trained, like, we can look at a bruise and tell you pretty much, was this done by hand? Was this done by an object? You're able to identify with a pretty high likelihood of what happened just by examining those bruises. When police began to investigate Yvonne's past, they found that Yvonne was in the middle of a paternity proceeding for one of her children. We always talk about this. Whenever there's a female murdered, you always want to start with loved ones. Like, you know, was there a husband? Was there a ex that would be upset? And all of her children had different dads almost. There was one who had two children with her, but the father in question for the proceedings was David Thorne. David worked in an auto dealership for 6 years. He had no history of violence. He was known for being a hardworking man. He was involved in mixed martial arts. His father took his life when David was just a child, and his mother was in a long-distance relationship with a trucker who was not around much, so as a result, David was raised by his grandparents.
David and Yvonne have dated briefly back in the mid-90s, 95, 96, and during that time, they did conceive a child. Now, David didn't know anything about the kid until he was contacted by the Child Support Enforcement Agency in April of 1998 to say, you have a kid, we're going to do this paternity test, and then you're going to have to start paying child support. So he took the test, and he actually started paying child support before the results even came back. David and Yvonne worked out a visitation schedule. They were no longer dating, but they did want to raise the child together, and David immediately started paying that child support. Unfortunately, David found out that the back child support he owed, so you have to backdate it and say you should have been paying this for however long. He owed $700. And at that point in his life, that was a very significant amount of money.
Detectives would let David know that they wanted to speak with him about the murder of Yvonne. And he was on his way to the police station. But before he arrived, David's grandfather contacted an attorney who then would stop David from interviewing with the police. If you put yourself in the police shoes, even though this is a right that people have, and I think it's a right that everyone should take, I feel like they view that as a sign of David's guilt.
Right.
Am I wrong?
No. And I think they did, but I have to advise anybody listening, if you are at all believing that you are being accused of especially something like a murder, lawyer up. This was the right thing to do, but at the time they certainly thought that made him look guilty.
So to keep the investigation moving, the police spoke with David's friends and family, and all of them would say that David was not, he had an alibi. He couldn't have been capable of doing this because of where he was at, according to his friends and family. So the police spoke to Rose Moore and Chris Campbell, who said that they had ran into a man named Joseph Wilkes. The two said that they saw Joe at the mall and that he showed them a knife and said that he was in town to kill someone. So let's talk more about Joe. Joe was an 18-year-old kid who had just dropped out of high school, and his IQ was below the normal rate. He had a severe behavioral handicap and was labeled as emotionally disturbed. According to police reports, Joe was quiet and stunned during his interrogation. Police told him to be a man and to stand up for yourself by implicating David Thorne. They showed him the crime scene photos and threatened him with the death penalty. So Joe confessed, but then he said that David hired him to kill Yvonne because he didn't want to pay child support and wanted full custody of his son. He told police that David paid him $300 and then brought him a knife for the crime. As part of the deal with his confession, Joe agreed to testify against David and then get out of the death penalty. One source claimed that this confession allegedly happened 5 minutes after he was taken into the interrogation room. I cannot emphasize enough, you're dealing with a man who obviously has some mental health issues going on and cognitive issues with a low IQ.
And when we think about false confessions, which is what we'll get into here in a little bit, we usually think about that happening after hours and hours of interrogation and being pressured into giving that type of confession. And since it happened after just 5 minutes, some use that to argue to say that he wasn't doing so under the pressure from the officers.
Well, I think in 5 minutes they told the kid that the police, like, he's going to get the death penalty if he doesn't say what they need him to say.
It's pretty powerful when you lead off with death, I think. The stories from Rose and Chris, John, I think are pretty fascinating. They kind of give different accounts of what Joe was wearing, of what the knife looked like. So there's just a lot of questions remaining here. Regardless, police would end up arresting David for this murder. When we get back from the break, we'll break down his arrest and how he ended up having to fight for his own life. July of 1999, police arrested David Thorne for being complicit in aggravated murder. David's family mortgaged their home and paid Jeffrey Hout, who was supposedly the best criminal defense attorney in their county, $100,000 to represent David. During the trial, Hout hired no experts, and he called only one witness during the entire trial. It's said that he often smelled like alcohol in the courtroom, and 1 month after the trial, he lost his driver's license because of a DUI. So far, it seems like he did not live up to being worth that $100,000 price tag. The prosecution, on the other hand, had a case, but it relied mostly on the testimony of Joe Wilkes, with the testimony of Rose and Chris at the mall, but Joe changed his story like so many others do when it's believed their confession may be false. Joe gave police two different statements to start out, but when he testified in court, he couldn't remember which one he was supposed to go with, and he got most of the basic details of the actual crime wrong, like what room Yvonne was killed in and where she was found. He testified that he bought a pocket knife the night of the murder at Kmart and saw his friend Rick Webb while he was at Kmart. But if you remember, Rose and Chris say that he showed them the knife, which was not a pocket knife, at the mall earlier. Rick said, when called by the defense, that he did see Joe buying a pocket knife, but it was at a Walmart instead of a Kmart. And it actually happened 6 weeks before the murder took place. And he actually had a receipt to verify the date of the day he was at Walmart and saw Joe. So the acquisition of the murder weapon, which I don't see how you could say that her throat was cut with a pocket knife anyway, but that's called into question here as well. When the attorneys had a sidebar with the judge over this discrepancy, the judge allegedly said that Joe must have bought that knife to murder someone else, which is a big assumption.
I mean, I feel like a judge needs to be a neutral party in this environment. And if he's saying that he's basically, if he did in fact say that, he is saying that this kid murdered Yvonne.
And
potentially someone else.
Yeah, that's like the judge in That's the Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia by Reba McEntire.
I wish that I could go back and play all of the testimony from this trial from Joe. Joe responded with, "I don't know, I don't remember, or I don't recall," 138 times. That's not a good look for someone who's being questioned. If you're asking me questions and I tell you I don't know almost 200 times, I don't really know what I'm talking about.
And his testimony is almost your entire case. And I mean, 138 times is a lot.
Yeah.
Just try to say it right now. No, you won't be able to.
His story was that David paid him to kill Yvonne, bought the knife used in the crime, and that David planned the murder and then gave Joe a place to stay before and after the murder. Joe said that he rented a room at the Comfort Inn on March 31st, 1999. He said from there, he purchased batting gloves and a knife at Kmart in the mall. Joe said that he walked to Yvonne's house and then killed her. He then said that he would take the knife and he threw it in a storm sewer, and then he took the gloves and threw them away in a McDonald's dumpster. He said that the next morning, Joe was picked up by David, and they left the hotel and took him to a friend's house where he would hide the pants that he wore during the murder, and he said that he hid those in some woods, but he could not recall where he hid his shoes or the shirt that he was wearing at the time of the murder.
Such a scattered story. Why would you remember what you did with your pants but not your shirt? Why would you? The whole motive here from the prosecution is that David didn't want to pay child support, but he paid Joe a lot of money to avoid giving somebody else the money. There were so many inconsistencies here, but the jury was still convinced that Joe would not confess to a murder he didn't commit, which I think we're just now getting to the point where false confessions are part of a conversation. They assumed he must be telling the truth to the best that he could remember, and everything he said was true, and the other things that he couldn't remember were just not important. David Thorne was convicted on January 25th of the year 2000. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, but the story's not over. In July of 2001, Joe Wilkes signed an affidavit recanting his confession, and there was a post-conviction hearing in 2003 where he testified on David's behalf. He said nothing that he said at the first trial was true. At this hearing, Joe stated that the detectives told him that all that was needed to convict me of this crime was a statement made against me, and that I would be put to death, that if I would testify against David Thorne, that I would be spared the death penalty. I was willing to make this deal to save my own life.
Well, I mean, police are allowed to lie in interrogation. So I really feel like what happened is they're probably interrogating these guys around the same time. And the police could easily say, "Joe, I have David over here. And he told me that you murdered Yvonne." And then that's when you could say, "Well, and if that's true, you're going to face the death penalty." And then that's when Joe could pop up and say, "Oh, it wasn't me. David told me to do it."
Unless you give us the whole story first. And
it's just awful.
And obviously, knowing what we know now about his low IQ and limits with his mental capacity, it's obvious to see how that could happen. He had allegedly told his minister that the detectives were going to light him up like the 4th of July in the electric chair if he did not point the finger at David.
In 2022, a Stark County judge dismissed a lawsuit filed by former police chief Larry Daugherty against the makers of the Alliance or the Murder in Alliance podcast. In the lawsuit, Larry claimed that the podcasters made defamatory statements against him in an attempt to cost him his career and negatively impact his credibility and suitability to perform his professional law enforcement duties. The judge said the foundation for the podcast claims that Larry had brought a date to the crime scene came from a private practice criminal profiler, Brent Turvey, who was brought in as an expert for David Thorne's 2003 appeal. In that report, Turvey alleged Larry responded to the call while on a date and brought the date with him to the crime scene. And the court ruled by using this source, the makers of the podcast were not acting with malice and the lawsuit was dropped.
Yeah, defamation lawsuits are really tricky. And like you said, it's they were acting on information from an alleged expert, so it was not considered defamation. Let's look at some other suspicious aspects of this case. In his post-conviction appeal, it was noted, like we said earlier, the crime scene was not recorded before detectives started taking evidence away and moving things around. So the original state of the crime scene was unable to be replicated or even described. The temperature of the body was not recorded, so they weren't able to put together an accurate time of death. They didn't even look at lividity to help determine that either. Yvonne's mother, Tanya, said that she didn't believe that David would hurt Yvonne because they were reconciling for their son. They seemed to be getting along on really good terms and that he had never brought up the inability or unwillingness to pay child support. She did tell police about several individuals who might want to harm her daughter, included a man named Eric, who had a history of physical violence against Yvonne. Tanya also mentioned a former friend who had stolen Yvonne's purse the year before, and a former Alliance police officer named Artis, who had allegedly attempted to sexually assault Yvonne in the past. Now, there's no evidence that these leads were followed up on, and there's no confirmation of the facts that Tanya was sharing, so it's hard to tell what actually happened. Besides a really short interview that they had with Eric, and he was in prison at the time of Yvonne's murder, but Tanya thought that he may be somebody that could pay another person to commit this crime, but nobody seemed to look into that. Police asked Tanya about a cream-colored truck with a ladder on it, as somebody had allegedly seen it near the crime scene at the time. And Tanya said the only person she knew who drove a truck like that was Eric's dad, who had been in contact with Yvonne recently. When Eric was interviewed, he also brought up Artis, the officer that Yvonne had accused of sexual assault, and that he had threatened her as well. He said, Eric being he, that Artis had also been stalking Yvonne and that she was very afraid of him. Eric's parents, Linda and John, told investigators that they suspected somebody named Shannon. But since Shannon was in prison at the time, they didn't follow up on that lead either. So it feels like everybody's pointing the finger at somebody else in Alliance, and the list of people not being accused is getting shorter and shorter.
The lead detective in the case wrote in his report that no one else had a motive to kill Yvonne, despite all these other possible suspects. David's new lawyer also outlined that David's previous lawyer had a substantial alcohol problem, noting that several people at the trials said that he was drunk and also had alcohol on his breath. More people also told David's new lawyer that they had similar issues with this previous lawyer in other trials. One of Jeffrey Hopp's former employees even quit because of repeated issues from his alcohol abuse. All of this, plus Hopp's failure to counter any evidence or question any contradictory statements at trial, the new lawyer argued that this was definitely a case of ineffective counsel.
And ineffective counsel is actually really hard to prove when you're using that for an appeal. That attorney, Jeffrey Hope, died in January of 2009 from acute alcohol intoxication and hypothermia. he had walked home from a bar and was so drunk and disoriented that he couldn't find his front door, and he was actually found dead in his backyard. The blood alcohol level when they found him was 0.27, which is over three times the legal limit. And again, that was probably diminished from the time he left the bar.
All of David Thorne's newly discovered evidence, which included Joe's recantation, was rejected by the trial judge. In fact, all of David's appeals, local, state, and federal, have all been rejected, so he remains in prison today. What, if Jamie, if you could go back, or if you had the power to do anything in this case, what would you do at this point?
Now, or if I could go back from the beginning?
No, I think from the beginning, I think a better investigation would be awesome, but I guess now is the only thing we can control. So if you were a judge, what would you do?
Yeah, so we don't have a ton of physical evidence, right? They didn't do a good job of setting that up and collecting it. If they were able to find that a sexual assault kit did happen, that would likely have DNA if she was indeed assaulted. I think Joe has already changed his testimony, so who else could say anything besides the primary witness that would change the idea of David unless somebody else confesses to it? I fear that they've done such a bad job in this investigation because there's really no physical proof at all that this happened, that money changed hands with David and Joe. There's really nothing there. So I don't know what you could come up with to dispute the evidence since there was none.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. The only thing that tied David to this was a potential motive of not wanting to pay child support. And then, of course, you have David saying, or the you have Joe saying, David paid me to do this, but then said all of that was bullcrap. So only thing you have is a fabricated motive. That's not enough to send someone to jail for the rest of their life.
And usually an alibi is good enough, but they, of course, claim that his alibi was set up just to protect him from being prosecuted here. So everything was lined up against David. Now, do I know who killed Yvonne? Do we know? I don't think so.
Do you even think that this Joseph cat was involved at all? Or do you think he just made some weird statements to these people at the mall or Kmart or wherever, and now he's stuck?
You know, given their inconsistencies, because I think one of them said that he was wearing like a white suit at some point. The other said he was in jeans. Like, how was, yeah, I don't know how trustworthy their evidence is. You and I always question eyewitness testimony either. What are they able to say that Joe told them?
Well, and if all he said was, showed them the knife and said, I was hired to kill someone, well, he didn't say who.
Right.
You know, so did they tell the police this and they were like, well, who's been killed recently? Oh, Yvonne, we still haven't figured that one out yet.
And they claimed that they saw the knife and one of them said it was a big knife, but a big knife wasn't used.
Yeah.
Or a big knife was used, but he claimed it was a pocket knife, which was the official story of the prosecution.
And then that was never, like, they never fully went all in on any knife. So,
and I think a good defense attorney could have picked a lot of this apart. Could have picked Joe apart on the stand, could have really pointed out the lack of physical evidence. I think there's more than reasonable doubt here, but it's really hard to unring a bell, especially the bell of conviction.
Well, and, you know, so that leads us down another rabbit hole. A good attorney could have picked that apart. Well, now they're saying he didn't have a good attorney. In fact, they're saying there's a good chance he was drinking or drunk during court. So even if they had physical evidence that could have tied to David, you could still argue that he had ineffective counsel. So I think all of, like, the no evidence, the bad counsel equals at least a new hearing.
I agree. I think he should at least get a new trial. And if Joe doesn't testify in the new trial, then what do you got?
You probably dismissed the case.
And I mean, Joe had a plea deal to avoid the death penalty. So I wonder how appeal of David would impact Joe's case. But yeah, I think he deserves a new hearing. Ineffective use of counsel is really hard to prove. But if you're like, hey, my attorney was drunk the entire time, he's no longer here to testify, it's like, well, how'd he die? Well, he drank himself to death. Oh, well, that checks out. So like, it seems pretty obvious that he wasn't very good. Not to bring in any experts, not to call, he only called Rick Webb, was the only witness he called. So
I just wonder,
seems pretty clear.
I just wonder, why wasn't some of these issues brought up during the trial? Like, we know that David's grandfather stepped up to the plate and was like, hey, you know, you're being questioned for this. You need to get an attorney. And then they get the attorney and now he's drunk. Like, why don't you just throw up some red flags and say, judge, you know, things aren't going great. And our attorney over here smells like liquor. So can we please do something else, please?
Yeah. I wonder what that process looks like. And again, we have some rumored quotes from the judge to show that he may not have cared anyway, but as a judge, if you notice an attorney's not doing their job, don't you, like, do you say anything, or do you just say that's the attorney he chose and this is the route he's going? I don't know.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I wondered at first, I was like, is this someone appointed by the court? But this is the guy that the family picked to represent him.
Paid him $100,000, I bet a lot of which went to booze.
Well, I don't know, man. It's honestly just a cluster all the way around. And at the end of the day, you've got Yvonne, who was murdered, and I don't really know that you have the right people being held accountable, which means absolutely no justice potentially for Yvonne.
And the other killer could potentially still be out there. So I listened to Murder and Alliance when it first came out, and I've been looking forward to this conversation literally for years. So, and I got just as fired up about it as I expected to be. So really hopeful that somebody listens to David and those working with him to get an appeal, and that he's granted some kind of relief or some kind of new trial. Cause I think if we're looking at, I don't know, I feel like lately is the revisitation of old cases. Like, we're about to let the Menendez brothers out, which I have no problem with, but if we're looking at old cases, let's try to right some wrongs. And I think a new trial here would do that.
Yeah. Man, Menendez brothers, God, we could do a Patreon just on potentially our thoughts on that.
Yeah.
I don't know what I think.
Maybe we will.
I think they murdered their parents, and whatever reason why, I don't know that it matters.
Yeah. No.
So I don't know. You and I may have different views on that. Maybe that could be a fun Patreon, but
yeah,
guys, we appreciate you sticking around, and regardless of what the topic is, we will have a new Patreon episode for you next week.
Yep. Thanks, guys. And we'll be back, I guess, tomorrow with another True Crime to Go.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.